From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on August 15th when Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced his intention to dissolve Parliament and call an election. That election was held yesterday, September 20th, and four Americans, particularly Americans who live in the United States, this is hard to truly comprehend. A national election campaign that lasted all of 5 weeks. In this country, the campaigns last 2 years, if they ever end at all. Trudeau had said his goal was to obtain a strong mandate for his Liberal Party to lead Canada out of the pandemic and into a state of recovery. But almost immediately there was a backlash, with some voters saying they found the whole thing rather cynical. They wondered if Trudeau was primarily interested in trying to regain a parliamentary majority, which he had lost in 2019. As the New York Times aptly notes, whatever the prime minister's motive, it did not work. Trudeau will remain as prime minister, but his party fell short, far short, of a governing majority. In fact, as noted by New York Times reporter Ian Austin, the total numbers barely budged. Austin writes, quote, "The standings may change slightly, but given that Mr. Trudeau had called the vote to regain the majority in the House of Commons he lost in 2019, without ever explicitly putting it in those terms, it was a vote to nowhere," end quote. So what are the implications for the prime minister and for Canada? Americans might wonder if the Canadian political landscape bears some resemblance to the United States political landscape, with the polls becoming more extreme. And how about that five-week campaign? The stuff of dreams, isn't it? Oh, man. Do they even have cable news in Canada? Do they have highly paid political consultants there? Why would they need them? 5 weeks? I mean, my goodness, it's barely a campaign at all, Dave Andreatta, who is the editor of City Magazine and a Canadian.
Right. And I will preface all my remarks by saying I'm WXXI's resident Canadian, which is why I'm here.
Every time we talk about Canada, here you are.
I've not done any original reporting on the election. I just want listeners to know that. But I've, of course, been following it closely as someone who has an interest in it.
Well, thank you for being
here. Of course.
And with us on the line is Chris Hanna, an independent business reporter for the Globe and Mail. Chris, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Craig Needles is a reporter and podcast host with Blackburn News in London, Ontario. Craig, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
All right, Chris, let me start with you. 5 weeks is a campaign. I mean, look, the American 2024 presidential election is going to be a two-year campaign. It pretty much didn't end. I mean, we all saw January 6th. It's just a forever campaign now. It's the stuff of sort of ongoing cable news dreams, but it's a nightmare for many voters. You guys do it in 5 weeks. How do you do that?
We're just very efficient, I guess.
This is
no,
normal.
I mean, part of it is the fact that, the way that the parliamentary system works in Canada and like in European countries where we got it from, you know, theoretically the prime minister can call an election pretty much anytime he wants. So, that actually seems to have the effect of making for short campaigns here, as opposed to, in the U.S. where you know always when your election date is going to be. People have, a date to plan around.
Actually, I already have a couple of emails. I was telling David Andreatta before the program that there's a couple of emails from listeners that came in on those subjects, which we'll get to coming up here. And listeners, if you've got questions or comments, David is such a modest Canadian. He said, "Is there that much interest in Canada?" I said, "There sure is, David. I mean, it's all Canada, baby."
Well, I like to think so, but I'm sometimes not so sure. When every time July 1st rolls around, people sort of forget. And they're like, "There's such a thing as Canada Day."
What's July? Is that July 1st?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean,
I don't think that's right.
It's you don't think it's right?
I
it's like Canada's version of an Independence Day, but in Canada it was more like the British government sort of just gave us the car keys and we were able to go out
on
our own.
It's a much nicer version of Independence Day. But no, there is a lot of interest, as evidenced by the emails that have already come in, which we're going to get to various themes here. But there are some I think, very important questions to sort of try to ask and answer, comparing, I think, the political landscapes, but also understanding, I think, why this happened at all. And Craig Needles, give me a sense for, voters are not a monolith. We understand that. But for people who are not used to, for our listeners in the United States, not used to this kind of a system where you can call a snap election, it's not just a date on the calendar, is it common to do this 2 years into a term? Or I'm sure it's not common. How uncommon is that? And how typically does it go most of the full term before the election gets called?
It usually doesn't get to a full term. Usually it's, you know, 2.5-3 years before a minority government falls. However, sometimes things go quickly. Between May of 1979 and February of 1980, Canada had two federal elections. So every now and then it just gets to a situation where people want to have a vote. Now, the difference between what Justin Trudeau has done here is he essentially dissolved his own government. He went to the governor general and said, all right, it's time to have an election. And then that's what occurred. Usually when a minority government situation ends with an election, it's because all the opposition parties say, you know what, we've had enough of this. We're bringing the government down and it's time for an election. So usually it's the opposition parties that in some ways drive the bus when it comes to sending us to an election. But in this case, it was the governing party. And I think that that's why some of the blowback happened for Trudeau at the polls. And that's why he was not able to achieve that majority government you were just talking about. As I think there were some Canadians that said, hey, you know what? I don't even want to be part of this election. I'm not going to vote for the guy who called it.
Okay. And I apologize for my ignorance there, Craig, but just elaborate a little bit on the mechanism here, because in this case, yes, August 15th, Trudeau essentially drives that bus this time around himself. How would a minority bloc do that? I mean, what's the actual mechanism for doing this?
So when I explained this to Americans, and I lived there for 3 years, and my brother-in-law actually is from Rochester, so I've had to explain it to him recently. I said that imagine the House of Representatives had 4 or 5 different parties in it, and whichever party in the House had more seats, they just decided to choose who the president is. And that's how our system works. So if you have a majority of the seats in Parliament, we have 338 seats. If you have a majority of those seats, you can essentially pass whatever legislation you want, and you don't have to get approval from anybody outside of your own party. In a minority situation, you have a plurality of the seats. You have the most seats, but you don't have more than 50% of them. So you have to find opposition parties to work with to pass legislation. There are some things called confidence votes. And if the government fails a confidence vote, that means that the election essentially is on and it's time for a vote to happen. So if all the opposition parties at once say, no, we're going to vote against you on this confidence vote, and budget votes and things along those lines are our confidence votes, that means that Parliament's dissolved and it's time for an election. So that's how our election started in 2006. And that's how election started in 2008 as well. We had two elections in 2 years then. So it usually is the opposition saying time for an election, as opposed to for an early call like this one, the governing party saying, no, we're just going to call this election right now.
Okay. And Chris Hannay, I kind of would love to get all three of our guests take on just how sort of brazenly cynical political leaders can be in this scenario, because in this country, it is well known that political leaders, and they do this around the world, not just in the United States, they use the mechanisms of government to try to ostensibly to help the populace, but it's almost always to help the people. That's why we see political leaders' names on Little League baseball fields and hospitals and fire halls. There's pork barrel spending. There's member items at the state level. There's all kinds of things. But if you could call an election, Chris, if you were the prime minister and you could call the election, you know, the truly cynical maneuver would be to print some sort of government rebate check for the whole population, make everybody happy, and then the next week call the election. I think that would be viewed so brazen as to spark a backlash. And it sounds to me like Trudeau sort of tried to toe the line this time around and claim that he wanted a mandate to deal with the pandemic, when really it was about trying to grab onto a moment, you know, halfway through a term when he had a pretty good approval rating, but a minority in Parliament, to try to sort of build that majority back in sort of a quick whiplash faction. It didn't seem that people thought it was a very honest way of doing it. But maybe I'm reading it the wrong way. How do you see it, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fun part of the system up here, I think. You know, the prime minister has this power to ask the governor general to trigger an election. And, it's up to them whether they time it right. It's always a gamble. Sometimes it works. Back in 2000, the then prime minister, Jean Chrétien, his main opposition party had just selected a new leader. The prime minister immediately, who had a big majority, said, okay, you just became the new leader, my new opposition leader. Let's have an election right now. Let's go. and it worked out for him. Canadians said, yeah, we don't like this new guy very much, and gave the government tons of seats. You know, sometimes it doesn't work so well either. Justin Trudeau this year, and actually in 2008, Harper called his own election, our Prime Minister Stephen Harper, because he also thought he could kind of time it, and he only got a few extra seats. So a kind of similar situation. It's a gamble every time. Sometimes you time it right and sometimes you don't.
Yeah, David Andrietta, the New York Times quoted Elizabeth Goodyear Grant, a professor of political science at Queen's University in Kingston, who said that Canada's not a land of election haters, but there was this time around a pushback against what was deemed to be too early a vote. She said, quote, from a political science perspective, voters want accountability and voice. So it seems a bit odd not to seize on those opportunities to exercise them. Even if the outcome is relatively similar to the 2019 federal election, rather than ask what was the election for, we could also choose to see it as an endorsement of the path we're on. But many voters were turned off by this, end quote. What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, well, I think that in terms of an endorsement, if it were a true endorsement, I think Trudeau would have walked out with a majority government. That's what he was banking on here. And I think he never really succinctly answered that question of what are we having this election for?
Mm-hmm.
He was never able to articulate that. And his opponent sprung on that. You know, I want to touch on something that I think it was Craig said earlier about using this analogy of the House of Representatives choosing a president.
Yep.
I think it's an apt analogy. Trudeau and O'Toole and Singh, the major – the leaders of what we consider in the U.S. anyway to be the major parties in Canada, NDP, Liberal, and Conservatives, they grab all the headlines. And Trudeau, of course, has all the headlines today. Trudeau wins prime ministership, if you will, something along those lines. But really, what's going on in a parliamentary system is Canadians are voting for their members of parliament in their what are called ridings or districts. And the parties then themselves, you know, choose their leader. We already know who the leader is going into the election. A vote for Trudeau's party in your riding is essentially a vote for Trudeau. But really, no one's casting a vote for a prime minister.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's an important distinction that Americans will maybe struggle to kind of get their heads around.
Sure.
United States voters are very used to just seeing a name for a person on a ballot, not necessarily voting for the party. So I think that's well articulated. And if I could, I want to answer the questions of some of the emails that came in early. Listeners, if you've got those questions, comments about this Canadian election and some of the implications of it with our guests, you can email the program, connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. First of all, Matt says, Evan, I can't help but think that the Canadians are doing it right. 5 weeks seems to be a short political campaign season, but there's just enough time to focus on the issues, not enough time to get bogged down in the absurd personal scandals that now dominate U.S. elections. That is from Matt. Does that make sense to you, David Andrietta?
Oh, I think so. I mean, and look, European countries do this as well. Japan does this. I think Japan had some sort of I think they had an election in like 29 days several years ago or something along those lines. And as you know, one of the panelists said earlier, it's really a function of how elections are called in Canada and then how much time you have between when an election is called and when the election has to take place. That number is escaping me. Perhaps some of the panelists here who have a little more grasp on the legalities of it can expand on that. But there is a window within the law that says the election has to be held within a certain time frame.
And David, you and I obviously both cover journalists in this country, cover American politics and United States politics. And sometimes the U.S. public gets a little cynical about the media. You know, everything's for the clicks, everything's for the headlines, as opposed to really trusting that journalism is pursuing, I think, sensible and important stories. But when you've got a campaign that goes for literally for years, a 2-year presidential campaign, I understand Matt's point in the email that eventually to fill time on cable news, you start getting bogged down in, well, this person said this what did Barack Obama say to these voters? What did Donald Trump say to these voters? What did John McCain say to these voters? And is it a bad look? And there's endless talk of horse race and optics as opposed to, you know, can we actually talk about policy and the impacts on lives.
Sure, and I agree, and I think that the 24-hour news cycle has fueled that kind of election campaign mania, if you will. It wasn't always this way. I mean, we need a political historian here to get to the specifics, but it wasn't always that campaigns began 2 and 2.5 years out in the United States. That's a relatively modern thing. Meaning in the last couple of generations, if you will, but it wasn't always that way.
Oh, I think it very much tracks with cable news. If you look at Mario Cuomo and how late it was, there was talk that Mario Cuomo was going to, you know, be in New Hampshire campaigning, and you know he didn't get on the plane, famously, didn't run for president. But that was, you talk about late days. That was voting was happening.
Sure.
That wouldn't. I suppose anything's possible, but that does not seem plausible to me anymore, given this forever campaign and how important it is to sort of be building this base, raising money, campaigning everywhere.
Right. The campaign, the presidential campaign, effectively begins after the midterm election. Really, that's what's happening in this country.
I mean, it's like, why do we have Halloween candy in stores in August? But that's what we do in this country. Whereas in Canada, they're sensible. Well, Matt thinks so. So, Chris Hannay, let me start with you on this then. Matt's take as a U.S. listener is that there's not enough time in Canadian politics to get bogged down in personal scandals. You've only got 5 weeks, so you got to focus on the substance. Do you agree with that, Chris?
Oh, man, I wish that was the case. everybody's human. These things come up in the 2019 election, in the middle of the election, those photos surfaced of Justin Trudeau wearing blackface when he was a young man. And that certainly derailed the campaign. And actually, a conservative group the day before our election, so I guess Sunday night, there was a conservative group that found a new photo of Justin Trudeau wearing blackface. And they were obviously trying to make it another scandal, but it didn't really get much traction this time because I guess all voters thought, well, we know. Yeah. We know what he did.
We've seen that movie, right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And every election, there's always some local candidates who have done something. So in the case of the Liberals, I think they had two candidates that were both accused of sexual assault and harassment. And so those candidates had to get dumped over the course of the campaign. And actually one of them who his kind of allegations just came out last week, came out too late for them to change the ballot. So his name was still on the ballot. And I actually think he won last night. Justin Trudeau has said even if he wins, he's not going to sit with the Liberals. But anyway, you know, well, scandals still happen up here.
Okay. Craig, you want to add to that?
Yeah, that is something I would say as well. And yeah, even if like sort of an individual micro level scandals, not even necessarily involving the leader, sort of dominate elections repeated at a time a few years ago. I want to say it was the 2015 campaign. There was a conservative who was caught on camera urinating in a coffee cup and then pouring it down the sink when they were doing work at someone's house as a contractor.
Oh,
so that was a thing that was like kind of a big part of the campaign for 2 days. And there were, you know, peeing in coffee cup jokes for a while. So that stuff still happens. Now, perhaps it doesn't get the same breathless coverage as it might in the United States, but that stuff is still definitely on the radar up here.
This is changing my view of Canada entirely. All of my view of Canada was David Rakoff and these wonderful, mostly people in the arts and literature. And peeing in coffee cups was just not on that list for me. So even in 5 weeks,
I'm sorry to wreck the illusion for you.
Yeah, you've got time for that. Craig, I mean, much more seriously, there's a term in American politics which is October surprise. So you know, once there are presidential candidates here, firmed up usually by June, but often by February or March, so-called Super Tuesday voting, this endless campaign then goes into 8 months to an election. But everybody knows in October somebody's going to spring a story. You know, there's going to be a laptop left somewhere, or there's going to be a photo or a video leaked. And it's sort of this weird pastime in this country. At least it doesn't seem like there's enough time for there to be, I don't know, a last week surprise, Craig.
There was a little bit of one this time, but it was more of a political surprise. So the province of Alberta, their premier is Jason Kenney, who served as a cabinet minister in Stephen Harper's government, as did Aaron O'Toole, the current conservative leader. And Alberta basically had to shut down again because their COVID cases were out of control and their ICU numbers were in a really bad way. This is despite Jason Kenney saying Alberta was going to have the best summer ever and releasing all COVID restrictions through the summer. Then things got bad. Aaron O'Toole basically didn't want to mention Jason Kenney's name on the campaign trail for the rest of the time from Wednesday before the vote all the way up until the vote. It kind of derailed everything the Conservatives were trying to do in the last 5 days there. So there was a bit of a surprise. I don't know if it materially altered the result, but it completely threw a wrench in the Conservative plans, what I would say.
Yeah, interesting. And Chris Hannay, can I ask you to kind of paint a little picture for listeners who don't know Aaron O'Toole very well? And I don't know if this is a fair question, but is there an analog in sort of American politics that sort of lines up for O'Toole?
I don't know. I'm not sure off the top of my head if there's an analog there. So I guess to go back, so Stephen Harper was prime minister from 2006 to 2015, and he was, he won three elections, and he was a real force in the Conservative Party. He helped found the modern Conservative Party in 2003. And so he was a big force. So whoever was going to take over after him was going to be compared to him. So after he resigned, they picked a new guy named Andrew Scheer, who led the Conservatives in the 2019 election. And he was sort of seen as coming from the more social conservative end of the party. And he didn't do very well in the 2019 election and got turfed as leader. And so when they went to find a new replacement, I think that, in Canada, often the leaders of the parties might sort of go back and forth between different constituents within the party, different supporters. So Aaron O'Toole was largely seen as a more moderate figure, a more moderate conservative in the party. He during the leadership race, he ended up tacking a bit more to try to be more conservative to fend off another challenger for the leadership. But, ultimately in the election campaign, he tried to seem as a fairly moderate conservative, trying to have some kind of climate change plan, trying to come up with a conservative alternative to child care funding, which was a big thing that the Liberals were campaigning on. The hope had been that Aaron O'Toole's sort of friendly, moderate image would help the party make inroads in places in the country that aren't traditionally conservative, places in Atlantic Canada or in some of the cities. But he didn't really get that breakthrough that they were hoping for on election night. And so, the big question for him will be how long he sticks around as leader.
David Andriano?
Sure. Well, I'll just add to that, too. I agree that during the campaign that O'Toole tended to lean a little bit left of center, if you will, at least by Canadian standards. But he came in to the leadership of the Conservative Party as what he called a true blue conservative who was going to, quote, take back Canada. And he seemed to be playing on this populist wave that hasn't quite taken hold in Canada, but is percolating. There have been a number of stories done by mostly American media looking from the outside at Canada about how Canada has resisted the populist wave that has taken over a lot of Western nations. But I sense that it's percolating there. And that is how he won that leadership position during the campaign. He then moved back to his more moderate position. He declined to repeal or say that he would repeal some gun control measures that Trudeau put into place. He softened on a carbon tax, these things that he had promised conservatives that he wouldn't do.
Interesting. And on that subject of populism, an email from Andrea, who says, I have a quaint idea of Canada as a place of kindness, universal health care, and hockey. Please tell me there is not a vocal strain of anti-vaccine, anti-science people and voters. Let me maintain my illusion. That is from Andrea. I don't know if she's talking about populism generally speaking, but I think she's referring to some of what has become culture war fodder here. David, what would you say to Andrea?
I would say that it does exist, and not to the extent that it exists here, but it does exist. I make my home in Rochester now because of COVID restrictions and border crossings and whatnot. I can't get to Canada as much as I would like, but my entire family is there. I often spend 52 weeks a year in a regular year. I might be there, 15 to 20 of those weekends, if you will, spending time with family and friends and that sort of thing. Hasn't been that way for some time, but I keep up with the news. I keep up with family. I keep up with friends, and I get the sense that is changing. You know, O'Toole said something that touches on the sort of populism idea, the us versus them politics that we see here in the U.S. That dominate these elections. And by Canadian standards, this was considered damning, if you will. I mean, every Canadian, he said, of Justin Trudeau, every Canadian has met a Justin Trudeau in their lives, privileged, entitled, and always looking out for number one. The idea is that he was trying to appeal to these blue-collar people.
Anti-elite. Yeah.
Anti-elite people. Yeah, yeah. White ethnic majority that's losing a demographic dominance, if you will. And, that we can take this back.
Okay, similar strains that perhaps we hear in some themes here. Chris Hannay, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, certainly one of the parties that did better than the last election was a party called the People's Party of Canada. So that's sort of seen as it's where the big anti-vaccine support goes at the moment. So to back up, after mentioned before that the Conservatives had a leadership race a few years ago, but a guy who came in second, a guy named Maxime Bernier, didn't like that he came in second and didn't win the party, and he ended up quitting the Conservative Party to found his own party called the People's Party, which he said would be this kind of populist uprising kind of thing. The party didn't do particularly well in the 2019 election, partly because it didn't really, I guess the mood in Canada wasn't really, there wasn't a lot to protest. There wasn't that strain hadn't really caught on. But I think under the pandemic and people who were not supporting vaccines, not supporting mask mandates, all those kinds of regulations, that really gave a lot of fuel to the People's Party, who sort of latched on to, you know, anybody who didn't like vaccines. And so that party ended up getting 5% of the popular vote on Monday night, which was much more than they did last time. But they didn't win any seats because their support is so far still fairly diffuse. They're still only winning a few percentage points in a variety of ridings.
I read this morning, it was Chris or Craig?
That was Chris, yeah.
The Conservative Party, though, didn't it win the popular? Did it win the popular vote?
Yeah, it did. The Conservative Party in the last two elections has won the popular vote, but has not won the most seats. Similar situation as you've had in the presidential election a few times in the last 20 years. That's also just happened sometimes with our elections. It's probably happened maybe half a dozen times in the last 150 years. It's partly in the U.S., Democrats in the presidential election can win huge by just racking up all the, California and New York votes, which doesn't necessarily help them win the electoral college votes in other states. But when you sort of add up all the popular votes, it adds up. So it's similar in Canada, where the Conservatives have a huge lock on Alberta and kind of our prairie provinces. They can rack up huge, huge wins there, get more than 70-80% of the vote in some ridings. But then they kind of struggle to break through in a lot of other areas in central and eastern Canada.
Yeah, and just looking at the United States Senate as a comparison, the United States Senate, obviously, two senators for every state, including Wyoming with a population of 575,000 and California with a population of tens and tens of millions. What you end up having is a U.S. Senate that is controlled by Republicans, but the vote share largely goes to Democrats too. So there's a lot of wonky things that are happening sort of in politics. Yes, electoral college, but also Senate representation in Canada. You can look at it sort of the popular vote versus who ends up with the prime ministership based on their own maps. And then to kind of bring it back to the question from Andrea, I'll send it over to Craig Needles, an email from a listener named Alan who says, Evan, Canada may not have Trumps, but they do have Fords. Craig, is that fair comparison from Alan?
There's some similar things to that. Doug Ford is the premier of Ontario, so essentially like the governor for you guys. And he is, I would say, sort of a far right of center, not like, you know, PPC far right, but still far right of center, populist style premier of the province of Ontario. His brother Rob, listeners probably remember as the famous crack mayor of Toronto. So it's a pretty famous political family, and there is definitely some similar elements as far as, you know, certainly Rob, you know, he says what he just wants to say right off the cuff. He doesn't really care what anyone thinks. He goes from scandal to scandal. That is certainly not dissimilar to some of the things Donald Trump has done. Now, the Ford coalition also includes a lot of people of color from various spots in downtown Toronto or various spots just outside of downtown Toronto. So the way that they achieve electoral success, I wouldn't say is the same, but some of the characteristics are pretty similar.
And what party are the Fords?
They're conservatives.
Yeah, they're conservatives, right? Yeah. Okay. Yep. So, Alan, maybe some. What, David, did you think that was a fair comparison from Alan?
Yeah, I think it's a fair comparison.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. After we take our only break, Barbara, I'll read your email about some of the dread that American U.S. voters, I should say, are feeling about the next election already compared to Canadians, which, you know, in Barb's view, Canadians don't have to think about the election until it's called, and then you only have to be stressed out about it for 5 weeks.
Well, honestly, I mean, I try to speak to my parents on a weekly basis, sometimes a couple times a week. I think this election came up maybe twice over the last 5 weeks. and both my parents just said, this thing's ridiculous.
And that was it.
That was about it.
That was their analysis. I love that. And Mark is emailing to ask, do Canadian conservatives oppose universal health care? We'll talk about that. It's an interesting question. Sarah in Rochester wants to know if calling a snap election like this makes it harder to govern because you never know when the next election is and leaders need time to implement policies. We'll try to get through all of those questions and more with our guests. Of course, you hear David Andriotta in studio with me, the editor of City. And Chris Hannay is an independent business reporter for the Globe and Mail on the line with us. Craig Needles is a reporter and podcast host with Blackburn News in London, Ontario. And we're right back with them and your feedback next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, the child care industry is down more than 126,000 workers. It's according to the Washington Post. Staff are leaving the industry for higher paying jobs and better benefits. This has economic impacts with fewer workers, fewer children can be cared for, and more parents must leave the workforce to stay home with them. We'll talk about the impact Wednesday.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important, best told, sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and City reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I cannot help but I'm thinking of your parents, Dave Andriotta. 5 week, a national election, and the whole of what they have to say through your consistent phone calls is, this whole thing's ridiculous.
This is ridiculous. No, really. And that was about it. I suppose
it's
if
like
there
a
was
good
any
comedy sketch, I
if
love
there
that.
Was any more substance to it, it would be that they both felt it was unnecessary. My mother in particular is mostly fixated on the COVID restrictions, which are still pretty stringent in Ontario, mm-hmm. where she lives, at least compared to here. Like, they can't believe that we're going out. I can't believe that we're going out to restaurants without masks on, but that's what's happening in Rochester and beyond in New York State. And so she was sort of fixated on those things and and didn't quite understand why there needed to be an election.
I love it. We should have them on. Why are you on?
Right. They'd be more entertaining.
You're busy. They had time. Next time it's going to be them. Barb in Wheatland says, I'm so dreading the next U.S. election. Along with all my friends, we are so dreading it. Our politics have taken an ugly turn. I'm so tired of seeing the lawns and the cars plastered with their personal political affiliation, some of them unfortunately becoming even obscene in their rhetoric. It has become so stressful. I wish there could be a law preventing signs being displayed too far in advance of the election date. That's from Barb in Wheatland. I am curious to know about how this works in Canada, because to Barb's point, I've said this on the air. Actually, it was a couple months ago. I said on the air that I spent a lot of time driving throughout the Southern Tier and the Finger Lakes for Little League baseball season this summer. And I saw more signs than I can count that have the phrase F Biden, but with all four letters there. And I mentioned on this program, I drive by those signs wondering, do kids live in this house? Are there kids in the neighborhood? Are you proud of that language? I can't tell you the opprobrium that I sparked with just that musing from some conservatives who say, oh, you know, kids have heard that it all, grow up.
Right. Well,
fine.
There are a couple of things to that, a couple of arguments to that. I've written about this issue. There was a person out in Webster who had similar signs like this that I did a column on. And first of all, almost every locality has some sort of ordinance on the books limiting political signs to a specific period of time.
I think it's 3 days after an election. Usually they're supposed to be gone.
I don't recall what it is, but it's not like it can go on forever.
Yeah.
It is a short period of time during the campaign season and then after the election. They have to be gone. But it also comes down to a First Amendment issue. So it's the sign isn't, you know, Trump 2020, the sign is
blank, you know, Biden.
Blank Biden. And that now taking that down now infringed on someone's First Amendment rights.
Because they're going to say, this isn't a political campaign. This is just my feelings that I'm going to display.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Interesting.
And even when there is profanity involved, which I suspect this wasn't the case, it would just say F.
And
right?
Yes.
F.
Oh, no.
Oh, it was the full-fledged profanity? Okay.
Dave, go out to Hilton, go all throughout the Southern Tier. It's everywhere. Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely yes. Somebody right now is driving by and taking a picture of it, and they're going to text me in 5 seconds. It's everywhere. And let me preempt this for anybody who's going to email me and say, oh, well, you know, you don't have a problem for all the signs that said F Trump with the letters. First of all, I saw very little of that. And yes, I do have a problem with that. If you're putting that out there now— Yes, I do. It's awful. I don't like it. I'm sorry. I'm the wilting flower of parent of a 9-year-old who I don't want to see it. I just don't.
Yeah.
And so I share Barb's concern there. Craig Needles, do you get any of that in where you are?
We're starting to see it more. So I was walking to work a couple days before the election, and right past me goes this giant white pickup truck with two huge black flags that were attached to some sort of bar on the pickup truck that said the exact phrase you're talking about, F, with all the letters spelled out, Trudeau, with a skull and crossbones on it for some reason. I don't know whether they think they're pirates or Trudeau's a pirate or something. I don't know. But that's something that you see pretty regularly at the PPC rallies, and they had thousands of people indoors at some of these rallies, which is not something we're supposed to be doing right now. There's a lot of that signage as well. So it's not something that's been common here, but we saw a little of it creep into to our electoral discourse in this election.
Mm. Chris Hannay, what have you seen?
You know, I don't think I've seen any obscene signs where I am, and I'm sorry. Yeah, just the normal campaign signs around here. But I, you know, definitely when you go to like social media, it's a whole other story.
A friend of mine just texted to say, oh, come on, Evan, the worst they've got in Canada are signs that say Trudeau is disappointing. I don't think that's true, David. Come on.
Yep, right.
It gets a little rougher than that, doesn't it, Dave?
You can look at my Facebook feed from my Canadian friends. Yes, it does.
Okay. And yes, the evidence is already rolling in. Well, I don't need to see more signs. I've seen them, guys. I've seen them. You don't have to email me the pictures. I've seen them. But Barb, I share that, and I share it for whoever you're putting that language on. Yeah, I don't love it. Mark wants to know, do Canadian conservatives oppose universal health care. Chris Hannay, independent business reporter for the Globe and Mail. What would you tell Mark?
I think by and large, no. We've had universal health care in Canada since the mid-60s. So it's been 50 years now. Everybody's pretty comfortable with it. There's always ways it could improve. And, often the idea of having a more private access in the system is something that comes up. We talk about so-called two-tier healthcare system, where you'd have a public system and then you'd have private clinics that people could pay for and kind of skip the lines of the public hospitals. And it's the kind of topic that when a progressive party like the Liberals or the NDP want to kind of whip up some anger against the Conservatives, they'll start saying the Conservatives want to bring more private sector in here. They want to have a two-tier system, but for the most part, the Conservatives kind of don't engage on that.
Craig?
Yeah, I'd say the same thing. Now, that being said, from time to time, if things are getting hairy for them, the Trudeau Liberals have said, well, if you vote for Aaron O'Toole, if you vote for Andrew Scheer, all of a sudden we're going to have privatized health care and it's going to be all over the place. So it's kind of used as a bit of a scare tactic, but the Conservatives would tell you no, they do not oppose the idea of having a universal health care system. They talk about the idea of, some privatization of certain things, but there's always going to be a public option. But yeah, the universal healthcare debate in this country is very much a very largely settled. And I don't think anyone wants to be the party that runs on, hey, let's not have that anymore.
Okay. When I raised this question briefly in our break, I was very curious to know what Craig and Chris would say. I think because David and I, David Andrietta and I have talked about this, and I think you've said the same thing that they've said, that it gets politicized. There are, from time to time, it comes up in the same way that Craig was just describing, maybe in an ad, that a scare ad about a Stephen Harper or an Aaron O'Toole. But largely, Conservatives have not run on removing universal health care in Canada, right?
Oh, I think that's fair to say. Absolutely.
It's kind of a done and dusted kind of a question.
It's done. It's done.
That is so interesting. Mark, thank you for that. I hadn't even considered that angle. But when you think about how analogous some of the strains of populism are in Canada to the United States, that's one where there is very little overlap on healthcare.
Yeah, if I could just jump in there. Part of it is, people like free things. Canada's healthcare system is not perfect. But the idea of going into a campaign and saying, I want to make sure that you get a bill every time you go to the hospital, that's not something that's going to get you votes.
Yeah, no, sure. And when if you poll the question of healthcare, the response in this country is almost entirely based on how you use the language. So, for example, if you ask people about individual tenets of recent healthcare plans, a lot of them are very popular. But if you then say, hey, by the way, all the things you just said you want, that's Obamacare, people say, I don't want that.
Right.
They change it immediately.
Well, people tend to forget that Medicare is universal health care.
Yeah, of course. I think Barack Obama miscalculated, thinking, well, Mitt Romney, put Romney Care out there. We're going to get both parties rolling down the tracks on this. No, it will probably be forever politicized in this country, although in Canada, not that far away, it's largely settled. Sarah in Rochester says, I still don't understand why you can just call a snap election like this. Don't voters deserve to see their elected leaders have time to implement policies? If you can just call an election whenever you want, it seems very difficult to accomplish anything. Again, that's Sarah in Rochester. Let me start with Craig Needles. David?
No, I was going to say, on the contrary, in terms of accomplishing things, the idea here was that Trudeau posited that if he could get a majority government, he could accomplish a lot more. So he dissolved parliament and called the election, hoping for that majority.
He's probably, he's not necessarily wrong on the merits, right? Any party that wants to pass its agenda would do so much more easily with a governing majority or something, a stronger plurality. He's not necessarily wrong about that, right?
No, of course not.
Yeah.
Of course, a majority government can get a lot more done,
and that's
at least on its terms.
Sure. So, I mean, in that way, it wasn't even necessarily cynical. He was just being honest that that's what they wanted. He wanted to do. But Craig, what would you say to Sarah, who says, look, if you can just call this election whatever you want, how long do we have to actually get anything done here?
Well, that's the interesting part of it, is there are some pretty significant issues that were talked about in the last parliament that have to essentially start from square one in this parliament. Now, childcare was one of the big issues this election, and the Liberals and the NDP were both saying, yeah, we're in favor of $10 a day childcare, working on deals with the province. So that became an election issue, but that's something that would have gone ahead, you would think, without bumps in the road if there was no election at all. Instead, that was put to a risk because the Conservatives didn't necessarily want that. There is a conversion therapy ban that was in the process of being passed by Parliament, that all of a sudden when the writ gets dropped, that means that all the legislation gets erased and everything goes back, not quite necessarily to square one, but close enough. So it is hard to do some things, but at the same time, you can sort of keep things going after an election if you win. And if you're sort of thinking about, hey, wait, do we want to have to go to the electorate knowing that this didn't get done because of an election? Is that going to be a difficult thing for us politically? There's something, an element that the political leaders consider because of that stuff. So it does make it a challenge, but it's not a completely impossible challenge to overcome, depending on how motivated you are and what you want to get done.
Okay, Chris Hannay.
Yeah, I mean, if you have if you're a prime minister and you have a majority of seats in the House, you can pretty much do whatever you want. So it's not really advantageous for you to call an election for a while. So. When Trudeau first came in 2015, he won a majority of seats. And so for the next 4 years, he passed lots of stuff, lots of bills. I guess I should clarify one thing we talked about. So theoretically there is, Canada does have a fixed date election law that was put in 15 years ago. So that theoretically, once we have an election, the next election is supposed to happen 4 years in the October, 4 years after that election. So that does sometimes happen, but I didn't bring it up earlier because there's nothing stopping the prime minister from calling an election early, as we saw this summer.
Hmm.
But that is what happened in 2019, was he didn't call an election early that time. He just said, okay, we'll go with the date that the calendar says we should go with in October of 2019.
And a couple of listeners, Chris, have asked about term limits. Any term limits for a prime minister in Canada?
No. The only term limit is what the voters decide. They can hang on as long as they can. We had one prime minister, William Lyon Mackenzie King, who was prime minister for 22 years in the 2030s and 40s. And we've had a couple other who have had long stays. John Chrétien in the 90s was about 10 years. Stephen Harper was about 9 years. So it's really just until voters get sick of them.
Well, and Trudeau's father, right? Was it 68 to 84 with a break in between, a short break, I believe, in the early 80s?
Yeah, exactly. Pierre Trudeau was prime minister for 16 years, except for 9 months in the middle.
Okay. And so as we get ready to wrap here, let me ask all three of our guests then, does this sort of cement the prime minister of Canada for the next however many years before the next election as sort of, a little bit chastened, a little bit humbled by this, going to have to govern from less of a position of strength? Does that impact Canada's standing in the world? Does that impact the relationship with the United States at all? I mean, what do you see, Chris Hannay, what do you see as the results here portending for Trudeau and for Canada?
I think in 6 years as prime minister, Justin Trudeau has shown himself to be somebody who's not necessarily humbled by much.
That's what you were laughing at, the notion of humility.
Yeah, he's still prime minister. He didn't get as many seats as he wanted, but, he can still do what he can. And he's in a position where he has enough seats and the other parties have enough seats that he really just needs one other party to agree to him on every bill that he wants to sign. And so there's three other parties who can be, dance partners for him. And so, he's not in a bad position. There's relative stability there. He just has to be able to work with others.
Craig Needles, how do you see it?
I feel the same way. He's going to have some time because I don't think anyone's going to want to force an election again anytime soon. I think the voters would be pretty upset if we had another one in 6 months. So I don't think we're going to do that. I think that he's going to have a little bit of time. I think the question is going to be, if he can't get that majority, and that's what he asked Canadians for, and they politely declined. If he can't get that majority, are there going to be people within the Liberal Party who think Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland is the right person to lead them into the next campaign? And is there going to be calls for a transition amongst the Liberal leadership? I'm not sure about that. I think that's something we're going to see potentially discussed over the next few months here. But the lack of stability may be less so from which party is governing in comparison to which member of the party is the prime minister.
David Andrietta, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I overall agree with the panelists' sentiments there. I don't think anyone has the appetite in Canada for another election anytime soon. but that being said, if the term then, if you will, runs out after that four and a half years, whatever it will be, it would be 4 years and 1 month. At this point, if that runs out, I think there is a real question as to whether Trudeau can withstand another election.
I want to thank our guests, and I want you to admit you were wrong. People care about Canada, David.
People care. People, I like it.
People care about Canada, especially like in Rochester here. We didn't even mention
it. It warms my heart.
we didn't even mention the Fast Ferry. That's all we ever talk about with Canada here. Fast Ferry forever. David Andrietta, of course, is the editor of City Magazine. Thank you for interrupting your work day to come down and hang out with us here.
Always a pleasure, Evan. Thank you.
It's always great fun. And our great thanks to our guests from Canada. Chris Hannay is independent business reporter for the Globe and Mail. Outstanding work there. And thank you for the perspective on the program today, Chris.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Craig Needles, a reporter and podcast host with Blackburn News in London, Ontario. Craig, where do we find your work?
Blackburnnews.com, and it's called the 519 Podcast.
Thanks for making time for us, Craig.
Thank you.
And to the whole team here, Megan Mack producing and engineering. Is there anything she can't do? Julie Williams, me, just Evan Dawson, saying thanks. Thanks for listening. Thanks for talking about Canada. Tomorrow on member-supported public radio.